Okay, so we were talking about issues of intellectual property yesterday, and we went through various models, and just one difference we didn't get a chance to highlight, just to highlight, if we look at different ways of formulating what the objection might be, let's assume that we can agree that to copy somebody's intellectual output without their permission is damaging them in some way that the halacha recognizes. If we take that as a stipulation for now, and the question is just what is the source, and we've seen a few possible sources, some of which see it as some type of gezel, a deraisa, a rabbanon we spoke about, or something in that parsha, or is there some other halachic concept or value that is relevant here? And we went through a couple of models getting us back to our original topic of Zenene v'zelo chaser. So the question could be asked, so how do you formulate whatever the monetary value is of what you're doing? If we look at, and essentially there really are maybe three ways to assess it. That if we look at it as gezel, so then gezel really should be defined by the item itself. You're taking the item, whatever it's worth. So if I steal a physical object, then that physical object is considered stolen. I have to return that or its value. And its value is determined by what's it going to go for in the store. And it's really irrelevant what my alternatives are, what my interest in the market is, or the like. So that's if you're looking at it through a gezel perspective. And we've seen that when we're talking about zen nene v'zelo chaser as the source for anything, we're mostly seeing it through a nene perspective, that focus on what you benefit. Although we did discuss that certainly in the Mishnah that's what's prompting the whole discussion, but we mentioned that the Rambam's position might be different, might be seeing nene as more of an act akin to gezel. But for the most part, we're seeing a focus on the hanah of the user and not necessarily on the loss to the original owner. So the question then could be asked, okay, if it's gezel, so then we're looking at the object's value. If it's something else, so what are we talking about? So if it's, let's say, a v'yahav to l'recha kavocha kind of concern, or anything that's driven by the fact that you are denying profit to the seller, so then it's going to be assessed based on what that profit could have been. And it's also going to factor in maybe whether you are actually a potential user or not. So if you're not a potential user, so then maybe the argument can be made there's no loss that has to be addressed. Although we emphasized yesterday that we thought that there should be a major chiluk between somebody who's not a potential user because he's just not interested enough, doesn't care enough, wouldn't pay for it. And we said it's a very hard definition to work with practically because of the effect that has on the market and other considerations. So that's one distinction that we didn't love so much, but if it's a situation where you're not a potential user because nobody would use it under such circumstances, nobody would buy a whole book so they could rip out one page for the airplane or something like that, so then that would be different. So there, in other words, we're looking at it based on the profit that is denied to the original owner, but with the qualification that there has to be a realistic possibility for that profit to have otherwise been there. When it comes to zen and v'zelo chaser, so we might see a different definition. That on the one hand, it's defined by the hana, it's defined by how much benefit the user gets. But what triggers that is the chisaron, as we explained different reasons for previously. So the chisaron could be the loss of sales from you. You're the one who wants to use it, and you maybe would have bought it otherwise. But there's other chisroinus also. There's a chisroin in just the creating of an idea, that the creating of the impression that this could be used without paying for it. So even if you're not at all in the market, then if we're coming from a zanena v'zachaser perspective, so then that might be something to note, that it's not just about whether you would have bought it yourself, but even if there's no chance in the world you would have bought it, but that you are creating the baseline that this is something that can be taken for free, that itself is a chisaron to the seller. And if there is demonstrable hana on your point, so then you should be able to, he should be able to make you pay. And even if there isn't, like we discussed, if it's a grumma of some problem, so then that should allow for at least a isser, for a ban on your doing this, and that's also relevant. So far, so good? More?
You spoke a little bit during Seder about machlokas between Tosos and Rashi, and how to understand what cluster is.
Right. That's related also. So let's open it up. So when the Gemara talks about chaser, it sounds like it's, when the way the Rishonim interpret it, it sounds like it's not necessarily its abstract status as a commodity, but more about how it's going to impact that moment. Right, that's what you're referring to?
Yeah.
So this is Rashi on Zanena. No, Rashi on Zechaser. Right, so Rashi Zechaser writes on Chafim and Aleph, the Chetzeiro Kaimi Lahaskir, V'Hava Mugar L'Achrini. He said, here, this is something which could have been rented out, and now it's occupied. So it sounds like the focus on the Chisaron is purely on that fact that somebody else right now could have been using it. And Tosfos has an additional component here, which isn't necessarily, you know, a machlokas per se. Could be that he's adding an element. You know, the language is not necessarily a language of machlokas. But Tosfos is expanding what we say by the chaser. The kolzman shiroan as that omeg veso in mevakshim and lahaskir. That, although it's not even clear, that's even different. It's interesting to ponder whether it's meant to be a significant difference. But the language of Tosfos is that people see that you're there, you're standing in the house, so therefore they're not going to look into it. They're not going to ask the question. So there,
Rashi is saying that he can't rent it out because there's someone there.
Perhaps. Yeah, you know, that it's not available to be used because you occupied it. I'm not sure if there's a significant difference even on the surface between the way Rashi and Tosfos put it.
Is it possible in the Hafkamina, maybe if someone does come to then rent the property while the guy is there, for Rashi, he's saying that it's not possible to rent it, but for Tosfos, it may seem like the issue is that no one would come to buy it. So if someone does come to buy it, then for Tosfos, there's no issue over here.
Well, not necessarily, because what Tosfos sounds like it is, again, I'm not even sure they're radically different from each other, but Tosfos might be, if you want to suggest there's really a difference, Tosfos is emphasizing just that people are scared off from even thinking about it because of the occupation. While Rashi is saying that the Metzius, you can't rent it out because he's there. But what would that mean, practically speaking? How would it play out? Like, if somebody actually showed up, so then...
It would seem that, I will definitely be moved out if Rebbe thinks to read a different way. But it seems like that for Tosfos, if someone is coming to rent it out, then there's no issue for Tosfos. It seems that Tosfos' only issue is that no one's going to come and rent it. It's not
right, so
like
that is a chisaron. The chisaron, people don't even look into it.
Right.
But according to Rashi, what's the situation? That if the issue is that it's unavailable because the guy's living there, so then if somebody shows up and the owner is able to deal with it, so then the owner can ask the guy to leave. And if the guy wouldn't leave then that's clearly chaser. Right? If the guy says, listen, I have a man right now looking to pay me and you're not vacating the space, so then how would anyone think that then it was a chaser? So either way, it does seem to focus on the diversion of this from usage as a active commodity to something else. But it doesn't necessarily inhibit us from saying that there's another element here also, that even if nobody else would come, but just the notion that this is something that people can use for free if it happens to be available is going to discourage anyone from paying for it, presumably. Okay, so it's an interesting economic study you can do to try to figure out, like, how much would people pay for different guarantees of things. Like, would people pay for two seats on an airplane because they want to make sure the seat next to them is empty? Even though it could happen that the seat next to them will be empty anyway. On that day of the snowstorm, I spent almost 6 hours in a Uber coming from Midtown. So at the time, I didn't know how things were going to unfold. But I went for the Uber pool rather than the individual Uber because was half the price, and then nobody else got in the car. So Maisa, certainly, once it turned out to be a 6-hour trip, it certainly was kedai that to not have to deal with the carpool issues. So it's the kind of situation where it could go either way. It's just one way you're going to be guaranteed to have it a certain way, and one way not. So it's an interesting economic question. How much? Where does that line drawn? So I think we talked about, say, the seats in the baseball stadium, that if people are told, you know, to say that you can't go down and take the seats that are more expensive that haven't been bought yet. So that, again, we understand, coming from this principle, that it's not just a question of you're stopping somebody else from coming there, but that it's in the interest of the business for it to be understood that if you want those seats, you have to pay more for them. And to say, well, let me show up and see if they're available and I can take them for the price of the cheaper seats, that's going to hurt their business. But is there a point where it doesn't hurt anymore? So, I don't know, let's say after the 7th inning. So, to say you can move down then, I don't know what the different policies are in the different places, but what the minute is.
Or, like, why would you take someone's ticket? Like, they leave early, and then you take their ticket and then move down. Someone actually
purchased
that seat.
So then it would seem to actually, it's an interesting nafkamina, right? Because it would seem to be more an issue because of the second point than the first point, right? Then you know that you're not necessarily preventing a sale, but you are stopping somebody from paying in the future by creating this impression that it is open season once no one's there. But the case becomes a little more complicated. Did he give you the ticket?
Yeah.
Right. So if he already paid for that seat, so he should look or have the, unless the rules are different, which they might be non-transferable, I don't know, but he should look or have the vitals to be able to say, okay, I could be occupying the seat.
As much, there's some of the passages it's non-transferable. It's illegal to, I think, in at least some places, it's definitely illegal to resell a ticket.
Just right. Like, so, yeah, but reselling is different than making it transferable because the impact that it has on their sales, the reselling is a much bigger concern than I can't make the game, I'll give it to my brother, I think. But again, this all goes out of the question of what exactly are the economics and what exactly would disturb the market. So let's say this question of going down after the 7th inning. So would somebody, if we say that that's something that can be free, so would somebody say, I'm not going to buy an expensive seat because if no one else is there and it's already been 7 innings, I could get it without paying the difference, so there's no point in buying it in the first place? Or would most people say that, no, it's worth it still because I get a guaranteed seat for the entire game? So even though, yes, it's possible to luck out, but how much is it worth to only get there for the last 2 innings? It's not going to deter anyone from paying the full price. So that's a little bit subjective and a little bit totally on minigamakum. Okay, so let's assume that...
One more point on that?
Yeah.
Why would we not factor that into saying that's part of the price of tickets? Meaning the ability
what is part
to
of?
M- move down is like inherent in the price. Meaning, why wouldn't I just sit at home and watch the game on my television because I want to be in the stadium? And then,
right.
Meaning, so it costs $10 to be in the upper deck, and part of that is this understanding that after the seventh inning, I can move down. Perhaps.
If that's the minute, that's the understanding. And you know, it could be that there is such a minute, but it's hard to say that it's true. Stop. And when you, if you're paying for a ticket, if you give your money and they give you a ticket with a certain seat stamped on it, so pashtus, that's all you're buying. Now, if it's understood that they let you move down after a certain point, that could become what the commodity is. But it's not clear that that should be true without that being established by some kind of practice.
So it's seemingly pretty clear that that's established by fans in general, but meaning it doesn't seem like the organization... What if the organization doesn't take a stance? Do we have to assume it's something
that is not
allowed? Yeah,
it gets a little murky. You know, if it's known that it's happening and they have the opportunity to take a stance and they don't, it gets a little complicated because theoretically, like you're saying, it might be in their interest maybe to say, okay, look, there's a little bit of an extra incentive to buy a ticket in the first place because
yeah.
You get a little bit of a lottery. Maybe you'll find that your ticket is more valuable in the course of the game. You'll have the opportunity. I don't know if that's the understanding that people have when they buy it and that that's what they're thinking when they sell it. It could be true. It's hard to know what the minig is.
So
but,
do we have to assume the most...
Fumrah
mindset?
No, not necessarily. I mean, it also gets to the question, you know, if we're talking about Gezel, so presumably we're a little more machmer about that than some of these other issues. Like we mentioned yesterday, we have to figure out what exactly is the nature of the chiyuv to pay once he says Zanen of Zechasser or something like that. So what's the nature of it? Presumably it's not Gezel, although we have to figure that out. So it's fair to say that, let's say in a Suffolk, we had that sugya few weeks ago, right, the question of Safek Gezel, and we explained that it shouldn't mean that Gezel is treated any less Chumrah than everything else. We say Safek Deraisa L'Chumrah. But you know, here, the fact of what's considered to be Gezel is itself in its vague nature. It's an interesting question to think about. Okay, so let's talk about, if we don't necessarily have existing principles to rely on, although we mentioned many, so what about the seller's conditions? Like we said yesterday, that theoretically there is such a thing as a sale al-tanai, right, if I say, or kedushin al-tanai, or other things al-tanai. If I say, I'm only selling you this under a certain condition, so then theoretically that condition could be binding. But we have a couple of questions to figure out. First of all, is it always binding equally? What if it's a condition that's completely unreasonable? So, does that condition kick in? What if the condition is not clear or explicit? Does that matter?
Shouldn't it?
Sorry?
Shouldn't it?
Should it not matter? That
no, I'm saying, doesn't any stipulation in any agreement have to go both ways?
Yes, but the question is how explicit does it have to be to be conveyed? So the Gemara in Kiddushin and elsewhere, the Gemara has a rule that Dvarim Shebelev Einam Dvarim, which is not a statement against Neo-Hasidism or anything else, or anything like that. What it means is that, not to negate the importance of matters of the heart, but when dealing with a business transaction between two people, so presumably all that matters is what's actually said. And if you're thinking something and it's not being conveyed to the other party, so then you can't expect that to be a actionable detail. This parenthetically comes up in some of the discussion with Chiras Chametz. Maybe we'll have to figure out what Pesach topics to talk about, good Bava-Kalma connections. But, you know, the question of, it's a tricky question, not to take a stand on this right now, but the question of, let's say, stores that sell their chametz and they continue to do business with the chametz over the course of the yantif, which is a very, very tricky kind of thing, and that going into all the details right now at all, but one of the issues the post can consider is, so does that undermine the sale if you sell something to somebody and then you continue to use that item for commerce? So certainly there's a big logical problem there, and certainly it's a very challenging kind of thing to work with. But just to be very, very letter of the law about it for a second, so if you sell something and it turns out later that you had intentions to keep working with it, so does that create a bittul of the sale? So some of the posts can point out that it's difficult for that to be the case, because if you didn't spell out to the purchaser that this is a condition for the sale, so just because you are thinking that you're going to do something with it, why should that cancel out the purchaser's purchase? If you bought something and you didn't explain any condition, so why should that negate what happens? It's going to come off his back. He paid money for this, and just because you have intent to be doing something with it, why should that undermine his chust in having purchased it? Now, that might make you into a gazan of some kind, and that's itself a problem. Again, that's a very tricky kind of thing. But if the issue is, does that purchase mean that, does that usage mean that you are undoing the purchase? So undoing the purchase is going to come at the expense of the purchaser, and why should that be his problem if there's a condition that you didn't spell out? So then it's a dvar m'shevelei. So in general, dvar m'shevelei v'einam dvarim. The Gemara has an example. But let's say somebody sells his house. And why does he sell his house? Because he's planning on making aliyah. And then it turns out that the job offer he has in Eretz Yisrael falls through, or whatever it is. He changes his mind about the aliyah. The circumstances don't happen to work out. So now he needs his house again. So do we say that the sale is batal because of this, because it was conditioned on the fact that he was going to move? So what qualifies for that purpose? Is it enough that just, oh, everyone knows he was moving and that's why he sold his house? Or does he have to say to the purchaser, listen, because I'm moving, I'm selling you this house, but if I wasn't moving, I'm not going to sell you the house? So that's one of the contexts where the Gemara considers this issue of Dvarim Shabalei. So one question to ask when we look at these conditions, these tanoim, if somebody sells you a tape or a book and says that it's on condition that you don't use it a certain way, so one question is that condition being conveyed before the sale, at the time of the sale? Yes, sir.
So in the case of the Nota Beihuda, is it assumed that you can, like, I don't know the times, and was it assumed that you can't use the plates for anything else?
So not necessarily, but the Nod Behuda was not coming from the Tanai perspective. The Tanai perspective shifts the issue. He was just coming from the perspective of absent, as we were talking about this morning, about, you know, whether a more explicit arrangement would have changed the whole story. But there, the point is, absent any kind of specific agreement about what happens to those plates, so does the person who hired the printer, does the author have the right to say what should happen to those plates? But here we're saying, let's say if I sell you something and I say it's on condition that you don't make any copies, it's on condition that you don't lend it to anybody else, let's say. So in order to even talk about that, so you have to have the condition spelled out. So sometimes the way things are packaged today, you don't see the condition until after you buy something, because it's under a shrink wrap or it's in fine print and people aren't likely to read it. So the Rush has a tshuva called Pe Aleph, where the Rush discusses that we assume Dvarim Shabbat Veinam Dvarim. So therefore the conditions that are applicable have to be conveyed to the other party. And if it's conveyed, but not seriously, if it's not conveyed in a way that it's likely the other party is going to know about it, then that may not even count as a condition. So then the next question to consider is just how genuine is the condition. And something Poskim pointed out, but really points this out, also in the Sefer Emek Halacha, I think we mentioned this, by Phillips. We talked about that Sefer. He has a huge, must have referenced it the other day. It's a five-volume Sefer in general on various issues and Chosha Mishpat and renters and the like. But he's got a volume on Zechuyas HaYotru, on intellectual property, that's like this thick. And like 100 pages on the Nen Ner question, 100 pages on this issue, we've got a lot to say. So as much time as we're spending on this, there's much more time one could spend going into these issues. But as he and others point out, the condition is inherently problematic. To say that, let's say I sell you a book, and I say I'm selling this to you on condition that you don't copy it. So what happens if you do copy it? So if, let's say, you're going to go back to the original bookseller and say, "Eschatayu nimazkir, I broke the condition, and I copied the whole book. So now I have an extra copy of the book at home." So what are the consequences then? So if we're going to say that it's a bittul of the sale, so then the original book goes back to the seller, and he's got to give you back your money. So it's going to end up rewarding the guy who does this. So he'll end up with a free copy. Right? He'll make his copy, and then he'll return the original and get the money back. So it's hard to imagine that's a consequence that the seller wants.
Does it matter what the person does with the illegal copy, as in for resale or just to have an extra copy?
It matters because sometimes the conditions are dependent on that. So you're saying if they make the condition absolutely and you do it less than that, so you do it on a level that doesn't have an actual hezek to him. So it goes to part of our question here as to what exactly are the various models, like we saw that. If you want to call it gazel, it might be one thing. If you want to call it just a denying of the profit to the seller, then that's also going to be impacted by how you're doing it. Yes, sir?
Well, it's even just backed by the view that it seems like that would kind of imply that there's this any kind of stop das by any kind of fear of it. I mean, I guess the question is, like, how do I evaluate that?
Well, that we see throughout, right? Then we have to figure out what the default assumption is when something isn't spelled out. Well, that we saw, for example, in the Gemara about Hochmah Menachah Arov and the selling of the Shor L'Raja, or that idea is, do we look at how something is defined based on what people likely do, or what the seller, what the buyer explicitly says he's going to do with it? So the issue of some kind of stam das is one that we find throughout. So in any event, so this question of the Tanai can be problematic, although sometimes the Tanai may be more sincere. It depends, is the Tanai one that the seller would really follow through on? And a situation where you violate the Tanai, would the seller say, okay, I'd rather have not sold this to you in the first place than you've purchased this and broken the Tanai? That also gets a little bit subjective, but that's also relevant just to whether it's a sincere Tanai or not. Because if the Tanai was violated, would the other party actually want to reverse the deal because of that?
Could you give an example?
Well, it goes to this question, like I said, example yesterday, let's say I want to sell you a car. And I want to make a condition, because I want to sell twice as many cars, that you can only use it on Sunday, Tuesday, and Thursday, and if you want to drive on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, you have to buy a second car. So, is that condition a serious condition? Let's say you were to tell the seller, sorry, I'm going to be driving it on all days of the week. So we say, okay, I'm not interested in selling it to you. And I'd rather sell no cars than sell it to you and have you use it all days of the week. So presumably, he wouldn't regret that sale. Presumably, he's trying to get some extra value out of it by restricting your usage. But it's not really conditioned on that, because if he had to act on the condition, he wouldn't. So then, that seems to be a fake condition. And then, it also goes to the reality of whether that is actually the understanding between the two parties, if it's not a serious condition to begin with. So that's an issue with the conditions, whether the conditions are really a practical way of enforcing things. That's a part of the problem. There is a often cited position of Zalman Nechemi Goldberg, Shlita, Zalman Nechemi in the sixth volume of Tchumen. I think that's at least the second time we've quoted one of his Tchumen articles this year. Zalman Nechemi is one of the great Gedolim of our time. And there are svarim that are from him that are mostly written by others and based on his shurim for the most part. So the original content of Reb Zalman Nechemi is mostly his articles. He's written many, many articles throughout. And almost every issue of Tchumen, I think, has at least one or two articles from him. So the Iker, Reb Zalman Nechemi Torah, is from these articles. So we mentioned earlier in the year, we talked about his article about being mazik, sentimental property, and or property of sentimental value. So he's got an article in the sixth volume of Tchumen, which is also one of his very often, this is up there as one of the most often quoted Reb Zalman Nechemi articles that he published. And it's his position on these conditions that the Gemara in Bava Metzia and Defayin Ches, the Gemara has machlokes about what is the status of somebody who is maivir al das bailam, that if I sell you something and I tell you that this is how you can or can't use it, so does that work? Which is also known as shiur. Shiur meaning you're leaving out something. Does the seller have the right to say, I'm selling you this item, but I'm reserving some rights for myself and not giving that over to you and telling you what you can do with it? So it's a machlokes. We say that maivir al das bailam nikra gazlin, that by deviating from the directions of the seller, is that called gazel? So Reb Zalman Nechemi maintains that even though we hold that it's not called gazel, against the view of Reb Meir over there, but it's still something wrong, that there is still legitimacy to a seller saying, I'm giving you this item, I'm selling you this item, but I'm also reserving rights to tell you what you can and can't do with it. And I think that could be the model here for understanding some of these limitations. So many discuss this. This paper, the Kalacha, you can find probably 100 pages on this sheet alone, whether this is something that actually works. There are those who argue on the premise for a couple of reasons. One reason being that the idea, especially phrase it as shiur, as leaving behind something, that means if there's some tangible usage of the item that the seller wants to hold on to for himself. But if he's just using the sale to instruct the purchaser what he can and can't do, so then maybe that doesn't really have any source. And the Chazon Ish, who discusses this question in the abstract, not in response to Zalman Nechemi, but discusses the question in general, says the concept of shiur is only if there is some tangible aspect that the owner is holding on to. Otherwise, says just petumei mile ba'alma, he's just talking, he's just saying things, but that doesn't have any actual tokef to it, that he shouldn't be able to tell the purchaser what he can and can't do. So that becomes an additional perspective here, and that's also a part of the whole machlokas. So what we've seen here is a number of different views. Whether they're contingent on the Tanaim or whether they are independent, whether it's actual gezel, it seems that one way or another, especially because bottom line is also a dina d'malchus avina factor, so one way or another, from kama v'kama taimim, there does seem to be a protection for intellectual property. And what exactly the source is, how exactly it be applied, so there are details that might be variable, But for the most part, it certainly seems like there is a very strong halachic weight behind taking this seriously. And that's something we should all be very mindful of. It's interesting, just to add one other mix, I think I remember if we've spoken in the past about the role of a cherem. When the rabbinate, whether it's Rabbeinu Gershom or others, when they make a cherem on a certain activity, how does that fit in? So here you find in some of the stages in rabbinic history that the Rabbanan had made a cherem against you publishing this sefer, that sefer, without the permission of the owner, or selling copies in competition with the mechaber, whatever it is. So there are those who will argue that that shows you that it's otherwise mutter, that the need to make a cherem is a way of saying that it's mutter min haTorah, and there was a need to make a policy against it because it's not already prohibited. So it's an interesting question whether it means that. Rav Schechter often points out that he thinks it doesn't mean that. He thinks that we shouldn't interpret the existence of the cherem as saying that, oh, okay, without this cherem, it would have been mutter. That really what it means is it's something that was already aser, but people were mezalzel on it for whatever reason. People weren't taking it seriously. So therefore, the rabbinic leadership felt the need to make a big deal about it, to issue a klala, to issue a curse against somebody who would take whatever action. But we shouldn't necessarily darshan from the existence of a cherem that without the cherem it would have been okay. So that's a discussion in general. The village take different views on that question. And I think that there's a strong case to be made, if you have more time to go into this in more detail, but if you have a specific question, if you think of the different haramim that we have, so you'll see some fit better into this and some a little bit less so. But I think the what you will see emerging as the path is, like Rav Schechter says, that these are things that are usur, but there is a need to make a public stand about it. And it's not going to be something like Chilul Shabbos. It's not going to be something which is clearly usur. The prime territory for a cherem is something which was already wrong because of existing Torah principles, but because they weren't so clear, so it was easy for people to be more ahead there. It's easy for people to say, oh, there's no real issue against it. So in those cases, the rabbis felt, okay, we have to make a stand, and we have to clarify that this is really problematic. So let's say, as Rav Schechter will mention, it says that you think before Rabbeinu Gershom came along and he said that you can't read other people's mail, so you think until then it was okay to read people's mail, it was always wrong to read people's mail. Or Rabbeinu Gershom said that you can't divorce your wife bal karcha, you can't divorce your wife against her will. So until he came along, it was the right thing to do to divorce someone against her will? No, it was also then also, but he came and made a chair. So what seems to be the Tzad HaShava is that these are things which may indeed be prohibited because of earlier reasons, but they're also the kind of things that people have the ability to be more hector. They have the ability to say, well, I don't see exactly what pasuk covers it, so therefore it's okay to do. So because it was already wrong behavior, so that's where the rabbinate of whatever generation would step in and say, okay, we have to make a public statement that you shouldn't do this. So that would work very well here also, that the existence of the cherem doesn't necessarily mean that there was no issue before the cherem. It means adrava, that all these points could have indeed added up to something, whether it was an issue of yahatarech kamocha or yashu b'hatov or some type of gezel or anywhere in between. But it was the kind of behavior which was really wrong, but we couldn't put our finger on what it is. So therefore, a cherem was needed. So it may just be a reflection of the fact that there was a pre-existing basis to say something was wrong. Hi.
Could we also say Derech HaDarkinon? You wrote that Shuvah Sarash.
So the problem that Shuvah Sarash was talking about is Isser Hezek being based on Derech HaDarkinon, because the assumption I think he's working off of is that Hezek is a violent act. So how could you say, I wish this was so pashut. But how could you say that B'nai Yeshiva, B'nai Torah would engage in violent behavior? It's clearly in defiance of the ocean of Drachei Drachei Noam. But here you're not talking about something which is violent, you're talking about something which might be Limud Torah. So it's hard to say that it comes from that.
That has like a vak of that she was cheating on the regions.
So, but
there's no way that.
Right, but that also, there are clear things to point to. You know, that is a minimum of Geneva's das. And possibly Geneva's moment also, because of your taking somebody else's spot and deceiving future employers.
I mean, more that the opening of, like, pass off there, so there's no, like, I know that this is only a hypothetical question because there's no way that Benin
should. No one would think that you could do it, right? Yeah, so, but this Geneva's das is relevant here also, because before we stop the question of, or move on from the question of intellectual property, so we've basically been talking about somebody threatening the profit of somebody who is a creator. But what if it's not about the profit? What if it's about the credit? So credit, here we know that there are other issues, that if you're taking credit for yourself, so then that's the biggest issue, because that's a Geneva's das issue. So if you're going to claim that you are the creator of something, and you're really not, so then that would seem like there's no tzad to be matter, that no matter how you understand it, there's going to be that issue. If we're talking about not necessarily taking the credit yourself, but depriving the actual creator of the credit, so that's an issue also. You have to pinpoint exactly how the issue is formulated, if you want to say that the Gemara's notion of called maybe davar b'shem omro, maybe gulu olam, is that an absolute chiyuv, or is that something in between? That's a part of the discussion, but in any event, there's certainly an issue with depriving the actual creator of credit. But most of what we've been talking about till now is the parallel issue here, not necessarily depriving them of credit per se, but you're depriving them of profit and what comes along with that, and that's the issue that we've been talking about till now and looking at various studies. So, tomorrow should be a Parsha day, so, and then we'll talk about tomorrow what we'll do on Sunday. I think it should be a relatively normal day. We should have Shira on Sunday. But maybe even at a regular time. I'll let you know about that. But it's just in terms of the sugya, so thank God we've gotten a lot out of it, but we should eventually move on. But still a little bit more to say. I mean, a ton more to say, a little more that we should say. So some of the practical issues we mentioned yesterday, the question of piggybacking on somebody's internet service and the like, questions of whether there is a concern of Zenen or Zelachasu there, or is that the way to look at it? So maybe that's what we'll come up with next. And a couple of other related practical issues, and hopefully be able to move forward from there. Okay, sound good? All right, I wish everyone a wonderful day.